This is an interview with James Blaine Hudson. It takes place in his office at the University of Louisville. The interviewer is Betsy Brinson. To begin, give me your full name so I can see if I can get a voice level.
James Blaine Hudson, technically the third.
The third, okay. Mm-hmm. And you were born when and where?
I was born September 8th. 1949, here in Louisville, Kentucky.
Thank you very much for agreeing to talk with me today.
Sure.
So, I'd be interested, Blaine, in hearing a little bit about your early growing up.
Okay.
You made up your family.
Well, when I was born, our household consisted of my mother and my father, and my grandmother and my grandfather. My grandparents had been educators in New Albany. My grandfather had been a principal of the of Scribner High School, the black high school in New Albany, Indiana.
Tell me the name of that.
Scribner.
Scribner. Okay.
Scribner High School. My grandmother had been a teacher there until her retirement. And then they moved to Louisville, basically to live with my parents at that point. My mother was working for municipal housing, or whatever it was called at that time. My father was a farm assistant. At times would have his own business, at other times he'd be working as a farm assistant, other people's businesses. And at the time I was born, the family was pretty stable, you know, never really large, but stable. My parents had been married since 1937. So when I was born in 1949, I came as something of a surprise, obviously. They, I guess, had figured they wouldn't be able to have children, and 12 years later they did. So my mother was actually 38 years old when I was born. It was pretty old in those days. And my father was 44, almost 45, which was old. So one of the interesting things that dominated my early years was, I guess, a major change that affected my family. Beginning in 1950, 1951, we began to have a series of deaths, primarily among the male members of my family. My grandfather, my great aunt's husband, eventually a great uncle, and then of course my father in 57, and my uncle, my mother's brother, in 61. And so by the time I was 12 years old, I was the oldest male in my immediate family. And our family had undergone a transformation, in a sense, from being a family that was pretty solidly middle class, at least in terms of resources, to a family that was, certainly in our case here in Louisville, on the verge of poverty, if not all the way there. And, you know, looking back on it, that experience, I think, was extremely formative. It was formative. I won't say it's a good experience, but it's an experience I learned a lot from that I think was valuable in later years. The person who seemed to really step forward in my family at that time was my grandmother. My grandmother really became the central person in our larger family, and probably the most important influence on me when I was very, very young.
How did she do that?
Well, my grandmother was a very unusual woman. She was in her mid-60s by the time I was born. Of course, I guess she figured she was going to enjoy a fairly calm and peaceful retirement. As it turned out, that was not to be the case. And of course, as the women in the family were responsible for more of the day-to-day, you know, putting bread on the table side of it, my grandmother, of course, her pension helped with some of that. But she really was the one who kept the family together. I had two first cousins. One of them's dead now, who are a little bit younger than I am. And so she had these three grandchildren, two in Dayton and me here. And, you know, she was the focal point that kept everybody together. But she was a very strong personality. Not in the way we normally would think of people as being strong. She was a very bright woman, very well educated, very well read, had been an educator all of her life. Had a very, very open and receptive mind for someone that age. She was always reading something new, always interested in new things, and always willing to encourage us, and particularly me, because I was the oldest grandchild, to do things that weren't necessarily the norm or weren't necessarily popular. She encouraged me in my writing, my poetry, in many of the interests that I had. And really, with her commitment to our family was really something singular. You know, and at the time, you know, you sort of figure, well, everybody's got a grandmother like that. But as the years go by, you begin to realize that she was something very, very special. Much of my early education came from her. I can still remember to this day shaping my letters in clay on a mirror that was on the top of a table when I was like 3 years old with her. So, she lived to be almost 101 years old, so she was around until I was, she died in 1986, so I would have been almost 37 when she died. But, you know, she was really a very, very, very special person. You know, we had a lot of special people in the family, and that was one of the things that helped keep us together. Our family has a very long history, some of which I've researched and learned more about it in recent years. But along with that history, there were a lot of very good friends as well as strong people in the family. Many of my father's friends and business partners, you know, saw what had happened to our family, because my father was a semi-invalid for 2 years before he died. He suffered a devastating stroke when I was 6 years old.
He made his living being a pharmacist.
That's right, he was a pharmacist, and so he couldn't work. And many of the insurance or other kinds of arrangements that exist now were certainly not in place then. And so not only did we have to find a way to take care of him, but we had to also find a way to compensate to some extent for lost earnings. And he had friends who were doctors that he'd gone to school with who gave us free medical care. There were other people. Of course, my family was part of Louisville's old black middle class. The man who was at one time president of Mammoth Life would take me out shopping a couple of times a year and buy me a couple of new suits. And
what was his name then?
Hankins. His name was Hankins, Junius Hankins. So there were a lot of people like that. And so, you know, even though my own father wasn't there, I had really a great deal of exposure to an awful lot of male images. My mother and my grandmother had a real good feel for, I think, raising male children. And not all people do, but they did. And it was, so I really, in a sense, had a lot of male role models to choose from, including the ones in my own family that I could remember. But it turned out to be a very rich childhood. Had its ups and downs, but it was a very rich childhood.
Tell me a little bit, Blaine, about your early education.
Well, I went to kindergarten and elementary school at a school called James M. Bond. Of course, Bond was a major figure in Louisville in the early part of the 20th century, and the grandfather of Julian Bond, I guess, is the best reference for him. That was at 24th and Cedar Street, not too far from where I grew up. Then I went to junior high school at Russell, which is now like an apartment building for older folks at 18th and Madison. In high school, went to a number of high schools. I started off at St. X, because between my 8th and 9th grade years, I attended a special summer school for gifted children here in Louisville, and the Catholic Church ran the school and all that. And so I was thinking very seriously about going to a Catholic high school, but I didn't want to do so in the ninth grade because I was, you know, there were a lot of things I wanted to do in ninth grade, like play basketball, and I was going to be editor of the paper at Russell and different things like that. And there was an academic award I wanted to win too, because there was a gold pin award for making the honor roll every grading period. And plus all my friends were there, so I was not in any big hurry to leave. But anyway, I stayed at St. X maybe about 2 weeks or so of my sophomore year, and that was not working out. I was having to get there too early and then ride the bus all across town, and I think there was one other black student there, no girls, the whole deal. And at the time I left St. X, however, I wanted to go to Mayo. But back then there was kind of an unwritten quota system as far as how many African-American students could transfer into some of these other schools.
Well, let me stop you there, because Mayo, that's a school that's completely new to me.
Okay.
But it was a Louisville all-Mayo public school?
Well, now it wasn't at the time I was in high school. It had been an all-Mayo school up until, I guess, the early 50s. And then it desegregated in the mid to late 50s. By the time I went to Mayo,
in terms of race. Okay.
Yeah, and so it became co-ed in the early 50s, then it became a desegregated school, pretty much on a token basis. By the time I went there, I guess African Americans were maybe a fourth of the school population. Within a year or so after I left, the school was probably 75% black. So, you know, Mayo was going through a transition during most of that period. But I didn't go there until my junior year. I ended up going to Atherton in my sophomore year.
Atherton, a?
High school in the east end of Louisville, generally in an area that's sort of upper middle class, predominantly white. There were probably about 10 black students at Atherton when I was there. Interesting experience.
It's a public school.
Oh yeah, it's a public school. Its history goes back to it being a girls' school. Like Atherton and Shawnee were the girls' schools, Male and Manuel were the boys' schools for whites, and Central was the co-ed school for blacks. But they built a new Atherton out of that area.
So the all-male school just kept its name all-male, even
Louisville Male High School
was not an all-male school? Okay.
Yeah.
Is that still in existence?
Oh, sure. Male is still here. It's a male traditional high school now. This is the oldest high school in Louisville, the one that claims to have the most tradition. My oldest child, my son, graduated from Mayo. One of my other kids went there for a little while, and nobody in the family is going there now.
Did you graduate from Atherton?
No. I transferred from Atherton to Mayo. Atherton was an interesting place. I had a couple of interesting run-ins with white teachers there. And, you know, I think
can
I got
some,
got a chemistry teacher. And I took chemistry in my first period. And he had a picture of a chimpanzee on the inside of the cabinet behind his desk. It was early in the morning, right? So anytime somebody would yawn, he'd open up the door and point to the picture of the chimpanzee. Well, he and I got along okay until I got an A the first grading period. And this is something I run into a lot. You know, a lot of white Americans are willing to concede that a black person may be able to run faster or jump higher than they can. They have a real problem if you're smarter than they are. And, you know, having had to sort of live with that almost all my life, it's something that has its own unusual set of dynamics. But the first grading period, I got an A. So after that, it seemed like he was determined I wasn't going to get two A's in a row in his class. And we had an examination. And I think there were 25 questions on the examination. I got 24 out of 25 right. You know, my math tells me that's 96. 96 is an A. Well, he decided that instead of getting a 96, I got an 88 or something like that. And he took points off because I didn't start my answer on the top line of the paper. And so, you know, I questioned that. Next thing I know, I'm being sent to the office. Next thing I know, I'm on the bus going home. And so my mother had to come back out there and all this. Then I had a Latin teacher. this is sort of funny. You know, I've been writing poetry since I was 8 years old. And I enjoyed Latin, but Latin was enough to keep you busy about 20 minutes out of the hour. And so when I finished doing what I had to do, a lot of times I'd look out the window, I'd be writing something. And this was one of those teachers that you just sort of knew that me just being in the class was a problem for her, this body language, facial language, the whole thing. And anyway, one day I was just writing some stuff while we were sitting in class. Other students were still working. I was through. So I wasn't doing anything disruptive. But she decided she was going to come by and throw my stuff on the floor. And then they tell me I was supposed to pick it up. Well, I didn't pick it up, so I'm going down to the office again, and I'm on the bus coming home again. And after that, you know, I didn't want to be there anyway, but... you know, I went to Mail the next year. What makes it so interesting, though, Petsy, is that when they made the announcement that I was a National Merit semifinalist at the beginning of my senior year at Mail, there were some people out at Atherton who had the nerve to talk about how they basically had made me what I was. You know, it was the damnest thing I've ever heard. And I was interviewed about that years ago, and I told some folks that, you know, the people that taught me in elementary school and junior high school were the ones who did that. But I didn't really, you know, I didn't have a bad experience with some of the other teachers at Atherton. I didn't have a bad experience at Mail. But you always knew that to some extent, you know, at Atherton certainly I was a stranger in a strange land. And that was my first real experience with dealing with that. But I also recognized that I had had some experiences that a lot of other kids in my generation at that time had not had. Because from the time I was 5 and 6 years old, I was involved in academic competitions. At the time, those competitions were just beginning to desegregate. So I was in the little spelling contest and little math contest with kids from all over the county. And I was one of the few kids at my school who actually had the experience of doing that kind of thing. And of course, by being able to do well in those kind of competitions, you know, my attitude toward whites was always very different from the attitudes that a lot of my contemporaries and my neighbors had.
Let me make sure I have this correct. You basically went to a segregated school, mm-hmm. through elementary school.
And middle school.
And junior high school.
Junior high.
And from then on, it was a more integrated experience.
Yeah. Okay. Once I left Russell, that was the last all-black school, mm-hmm. that I would ever attend. Yeah.
I wonder, Blaine, growing up, though, in a segregated society, when do you recall when you first were aware that it was a segregated society?
You know, that's an interesting question, because one of the things about segregation as it existed, and it was ending when I was real young in this sense, but segregation in American society was so complete that it literally created two separate worlds. And you could be a part of one of those worlds and not have much of a clue as to what was going on beyond its boundaries. I can remember, you know, my mother taking me downtown sometimes when she would go shopping, because after my father got sick, we didn't have the use of a car anymore, so we had to ride the bus and so forth. And, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, there are these crowds of these very, very white people. Now, of course, again, you know, I had seen white kids at these academic competitions, and so it didn't seem unusual to me. But You became, you know, African Americans had to be very much aware of the boundaries, because if you guessed wrong about one of those boundaries, you could end up in big trouble. You could end up dead. And white Americans didn't necessarily need to be as conscious of that, but African Americans did. And so to some extent, even in a segregated world, the culture, whether it's the culture of the street or what people talk about in the home, is designed to help prepare you to deal with what you've got to deal with. How, you know, what do these encounters mean if you have them? And then, of course, your own experience has to be a way of either refining that knowledge or replacing it, you know, with new information. But it was a different kind of society. I mean, I can remember when my father was sick and he couldn't drive anymore, and they got me into Cub Scouts. And we'd ride the bus sometimes. And of course, buses coming out of the West End back, you know, back in those days, if you went all the way down to Shawnee Park, all that was white, you know. And so you'd have people on the bus, you know, coming out of the deep part of the West End who were white, going, you know, going through the black part of the West End to the east. And so you get on the bus, and, you know, the folks, you know, they just assume that you're supposed to sit in the back part of the bus, or at least not in the front part of the bus and all that. And, you know, my father was, you know, some of the stuff I didn't pay attention to at all at the time, but, you know, he'd always make a point of sitting where he wanted to sit. And even though he wasn't entirely himself anymore, and my father was not a radical from a political standpoint at all. You know, he's an old Mississippi fella, and he'd come a long way just to be where he was, really. But, you know, those kinds of things were commonplace. And of course, as you became more and more aware of those kinds of things, you know, it was very easy to understand what it was you were fighting against, the barriers you were fighting to break down.
Do you remember now, as a young boy, ever trying to resist that in any way? Now, I'll give you an example. For, the separate water fountains and the separate counters, sometimes children especially would just test those out a little bit.
Well, I think in my case, it was a matter of timing. I mean, Louisville was not a big place for having separate fountains and that kind of stuff that you'd find in a more obvious sense farther south. By the time I was really old enough to do a lot of traveling around on my own, a lot of that stuff was illegal. Now, I can remember by the time I was in my like middle school or junior high school years, might have been what, the summer of 1963, there was a movie on uptown that I wanted to go see. And I always remember the public accommodations ordinance in Louisville had been signed. And it was to take effect, I think, the Monday, because I was up there on a Saturday. It was going to take effect 2 days later. And, you know, I walked up to the ticket office, and a woman would not let me in the theater. But that was about it. The opportunities really weren't there. Now, I can remember when we had the demonstrations here in like 60, in the winter of 61, the Nothing New for Easter campaign. And I remember wanting very, very much to participate in that. I had an older cousin who was involved in some of that. And I think by that time, you know, many of us were beginning to get a sense of what a movement was, and that, you know, that this was something that was important to relate to. But generally, you know, my life was pretty much contained in, you know, within the bounds of the West End of Louisville's black community. And when I went outside that, it was usually under conditions that were pretty well controlled. So, okay.
What year did you graduate high school?
67.
67. Okay. And then what? What happened to you?
Well, when you came out here to U of L, I had taken classes at U of L in 66, 67, and enjoyed it, of course, you know, with me being an only child. And the decision to come here was an interesting one. I had thought a lot about going elsewhere. I had had a lot of offers with this merit scholarship business to go around, and I guess I could have taken that where I wanted to. But I decided to stay here. The man after whom this building is named, Woodrow Strickler, who was then the executive vice president of U of L, actually recruited me directly. Had my mother and me into his office, because my mother was sold right at that point. And so I came here after I graduated from Mail. And initially, I was leaning very much in the direction of the sciences. Because I was still writing, and I'd become very interested in history based on the classes that I took here as a senior. And it's in my freshman year that as I look back on it, I made a number of decisions. You know, one of those decisions was that I wanted to major in history and not in physics. And I don't think I've taken a math or a physics class since then. I keep up with some of that in terms of the journals and magazines, but you know, it's 30 years ago, so I'm only so serious I can be right now. And I think I began to get a lot more focused in terms of Black nationalism and movement related issues. I'd had some involvement with open housing period here, and of course that was a real interesting period. I was in high school when that was going on. And
was your mother at that time working for the city?
Well, she was working for, she worked for municipal housing, and by then, I guess mother was, she'd become a project manager by then.
How was that for her, with you being active out there and
open housing
or whatever, because as I recall,
the real activism came at U of L, but the open housing stuff was it wasn't anything that led me going to jail. I mean, going to a meeting here, a meeting there. You know, there were others who were much more involved than I was. I just was involved to some extent. You know, my mother and my grandmother, I think, were always had mixed feelings about that. You know, they supported, and my grandmother definitely supported, you know, me trying to stand up for what I believed in, but they also were very concerned that, you know, if you go too far, you can chop, get your legs chopped off. And yeah, it's not always easy to figure out, you know, where that point is, you know, in terms of how far you can or can't go. So there was always this kind of push and pull, and of course, quite frankly, I mean, I was always determined to do exactly what I wanted to do. And that made for an interesting family, because I was about as hard-headed as my grandmother. My mother was sort of in between. She was the one who was not as, who would not be as unyielding as my grandmother and I could be. So she ended up sort of getting pulled in a couple of different directions at times, I think. But
well, now, as you know, I've interviewed your mother, mm-hmm. Lillian Hudson, mm-hmm. and I remember her telling me that I believe you had, when you finished high school, you had an AFL-CIO scholarship.
That was the company that sponsored the merit scholarship.
Yeah. Okay. And that you were looking at the University of Michigan, among other places.
Michigan State.
But you, why did you elect to stay here in Louisville?
Well, part of it was family, part of it girlfriend, part of it, you know, as I look, I think a lot of it was family. I mean, you know, one of the consequences, I think, of the circumstances of my early life, you know, the age of my parents when I was born, what happened to the men in my family, was that whether I liked it or not, or whether I wanted it or not, there's been a degree of responsibility for the, you know, the older folks in my immediate family that's just been there. There hadn't been anybody else to do that. And it didn't always mean that there was an active involvement, but it's a lot easier when you're close. And so I think all those things together, and then probably there was something else too, Betsy. I didn't think it made any difference. I mean, to be honest with you, I really didn't think. I probably had a greater breadth of knowledge when I was 18 years old than I do now. You know, the areas in which I have specialized, and I'm probably more specialized in more areas than you normally find, which is one of the reasons why I like being in a multidisciplinary department like this, because I can do history, and I can do social science, and I can do education. But, and I can still write poetry on my own time. But, you know, even with the breadth of what I deal with now, it's not like it was when I was 18 years old, primarily because there's no way I probably lost more in terms of what I knew in science and math than I've gained in some of the other areas. So, you know, when I was 18 years old, you know, my attitude basically was, I mean, you know, give me a little quiet time in a good library and I'll learn no matter where you put me. And my attitude still is basically like that. So having,
you know, having a degree from a prestigious university.
Oh, it didn't mean anything to me. No, it didn't mean anything. And I mean, I faced that same issue when I decided to work on my doctorate. And of course, I had some of the same concerns, because by then I was married. Because my mother and my grandmother were older than they'd been before. My mother was about ready to retire. My grandmother was very old. By the time I went away to school, you know, she was in her early 90s, you know, when I was working on my doctorate.
And you did that at the University
in
of
UK.
Kentucky.
So. Yeah, in UK.
But that required a residential period?
Yeah, I was down there for about a year, but really just part of the week. I'd be down there about 5 days, and I'd come back here on the weekend. And that worked fine. But, you know, I had a lot of, I could have gone to Harvard again. I mean, just like I could have gone coming out of high school. And, you know, and I've gone back and forth up there over the years to work on different projects and go to conferences and all that, but it's no big deal.
So you came to the University of Louisville as an undergraduate in 1967
on a full-time basis.
And at what point did you begin to get involved with the Black student?
Well, BSU sort of developed in a couple of stages. The kind of proto-BSU stage was in 67, 68, and when there were a lot of folks who were generally supportive of what was going on in the larger national movement, which had become pretty nationalistic then. You know, Black Power was the word of the day. But we hadn't figured out what to do organizationally with that yet. King's assassination, I think, had a catalyzing effect. And so by the time everybody came back in the fall of 68, there was a pretty strong determination not only to be organized but to do some stuff, you know. And, you know, Black student unions all over the country were doing a lot of different things. And of course, so we didn't see ourselves as being isolated. We didn't see ourselves as being leaders or followers in the sense. But in a sense, you know, we perceived what we were doing as just sort of the Louisville version or Louisville branch of a much larger movement. And
let me just stop and ask, how many Black students were on campus at that point, and how many of them do you think were active? in BSU?
Well, the active numbers, I can tell you, we probably had 20 to 30 active people, and maybe half of that when it came down to folks who were really willing to take some sort of risk. And then on campus, there would have been maybe, well, there were several hundred African-American students. Now, a lot of them came out here at night, so they were kind of an invisible population to many of us, but they were here.
Somewhere I have a 2% of the total student body kind of number.
Yeah, U of L had about 10,000 students then, and you would have had a few hundred that would have been black. So we were not a majority, but we had a pretty broad base of support in some ways. But a couple of things that I guess were very important for me during that period, that in a sense have sort of shaped a lot of my later work. One, I became editor of our newsletter, which is our propaganda sheet. I was really doing this some of this early, late the year before. And the other, I became the head of the tutoring program for BSU. I set up little tutoring centers in different parts of the West End, and we sort of rotate through those. We had some money from the admissions office that helped pay us for doing some of that. But what that did for me, because I was about the youngest person in the organization. There were a lot of folks like Jerry Neal, and some of them were like four or five years older than me. But I think it helped establish the link between political activism and working in a real tangible sense for constructive social change. That you got to do more than talk about the ways in which a society should be changed. You've got to get involved in changing it. And learning how to do that, because it's easy to say what somebody else ought to do, but it's not that easy to get the knowledge base and the skills that are necessary to make those changes happen yourself. And that was a very good experience. Now, of course, we got progressively more radical. We developed a proposal during the fall of 68, and it was presented in early March of 69, recruitment proposal, we called it, but it had a little bit of everything in there, including the creation of this department, and a lot of things that are around even now, which is something that when some of us still get together, we really take a lot of pride in that, because in some respects, I think we were a lot more forward-looking than many of our contemporaries were, largely because so many of the things that we envisioned, really did have a niche. They really did have a purpose. And again, PAS is still here. Office of Minority Affairs is still here. So there are some things that have lasted 30 years, oddly enough. And of course, the great irony of all is for me to end up working in this setup after all these years.
And be the chair of the program.
Yeah. I never would have thought that would have happened. But
let me ask you, though, in terms of other black student union groups at other Kentucky or maybe Indiana, Ohio, was there any sort of a network there?
Well, not exactly. I mean, you had in the earlier days, you'd had groups like SNCC that had a kind of unifying force, but by then SNCC was in fragments. Mm-hmm. Once the whole Black Power issue came up, SNCC split, and then you had the Stokely faction and then everybody else, and so SNCC in a way just sort of dissolved. The Black Panther Party was becoming, very well known at that time, but the Panthers were never strong here. Panthers tended to be strongest in areas that didn't have strong pre-existing organizations. Areas that had fairly strong organizations there to begin with tended not to have real strong Panther chapters. And Louisville was one of the areas where there was a lot going on. So the Panthers were here, but they were never a real force here. But when you get right down to it, A movement is more like a network, a more loosely defined network than it is a big formal organization with dues and bylaws and a building and that kind of thing. Now in Kentucky, there wasn't much going on outside of Louisville, quite frankly. And so part of what we did as a BSU was to try to start BSUs on the other campuses. And we traveled around the state, the Eastern and Western, and UK, and places like that.
And we did a lot. I think had one too.
Yeah, went to Berea. And we tried to plant BSUs at the high schools locally around here and all of that. And that was fun. There was a group of a couple of folks down in UK who got very involved, Mike Bernard, Benny, and some of them. God, I can't remember all the names anymore.
Bill Turner?
I'm sorry?
Bill Turner, was he? Remember that name at all?
Bill Turner. I'm not sure if he was one of that group or not, but there was a group that got accused of trying to firebomb a library or some building down there. Maybe the same year we all got put out of school here. Mm-hmm. And that's the group that probably identified most closely with the politics that sort of drove us. Anyway, we presented this proposal early part of March, and then we got into about a 6-week negotiation cycle with the administration. And negotiations, they always break down eventually because we kept sort of up in the ante. But in the end, they broke down over the issue of who would be the director of the Office of Black Affairs. You know, the university gave a fair amount of ground, so we knew that some good things were going to happen anyway. And that negotiation process was fascinating. One of the things that I did for the organization, along with dealing with the newspaper and the tutoring program, was to help sort of design our negotiation strategy. And I've always told people over the years that some of what we did in BSU taught, I think, all of us a lesson that we couldn't have learned anywhere else, and that was how power works. Not that we had it, but how power works. Because, you know, it's and what you can do to make power respond to you, and what can happen if you miscalculate sometimes too. But it was really an interesting experience for someone who was 19 years old to have. But negotiations broke down over who the director was going to be. You know, we took the next step, which was, you know, to take some illegal action on campus. We did a number of things.
Well, I want to ask you about that, but what had the university agreed to at the point that the...
They had agreed to establish an Office of Black Affairs. They had agreed to, I think, create the collection in the library. They had agreed to these, what we called Martin Luther King scholarships. Now, we were still haggling over how many, but they'd agreed to create a fair number of them. And that's still around, as a matter of fact. But the issue of who would be the director of the office, we wanted Sterling Neal to be the director. They had somebody else in mind. Now, the person they had in mind was our third choice, and a man named Hanford Stafford. And Stafford has his doctorate from UK now, but he was a student down there in the history department then. And I had worked with Stafford in the Community Action Commission job that I had back in the summer of 68. Well, Stafford was okay, but we wanted to have our own director. And of course, Sterling was one of the members of the group. But Sterling was about in his late 20s then. He had his master's degree, the whole nine yards, so he was qualified for it. But they didn't want any part of that, so that's where things broke down.
Why do you think they didn't like him?
Well, I think they were afraid that he would just be too difficult to control, basically. That he would be more an extension of us than an extension of them, which was probably true. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that would have been a bad thing, but people thought it would have been a bad thing. But anyway, we held a couple of different kinds of demonstrations out here. We disrupted the campus to some extent and some other ways too. And first day, we took over the president's office. And we were able to negotiate kind of like a temporary amnesty with the president at the end of that day. Still had the same demands. Of course, I did all the press statements and all this kind of stuff. And most of the press releases, which was interesting, working with the media is an interesting thing to do. And it worked out well for us to do with that, but to have one person that the media typically would deal with. We put some new stuff back on, the same stuff back on the table. The university moved a little bit. They didn't move far enough. So next day.
Did you have any curriculum issues and all of that?
Oh, sure. That was all that was well, part that, of the proposal. Creating a department like this, a full-fledged Black Studies curriculum. But we were very specific about wanting a Pan-African Studies department then. Not an African-American Studies department, but a Pan-African Studies department. And this, to some extent, had to do with the way some of us were coming to look at Africa and the Caribbean. It was, real elementary at the time, but it was an important perspective to have. So, we had some big curriculum issues, student issues, the whole deal, academic culture issues. Mm-hmm. There were some patrol issues. We wanted to have 5 Black people on the Board of Trustees. We wanted to establish university centers in all the war on poverty target areas in the West End. There was a whole lot of stuff involved in that. And the second proposal we did, which is the one, I wrote the second one entirely myself. This was the one that had much more of a community focus because there was everything in there from a Black university to Black daycare centers to everything else. And we actually had a building that the university gave us a down payment on after we got kicked out of school. They gave Bob Martin a check for $1,000 as a down payment on this building, hoping we just go away someplace. And the problem was we didn't have any way to keep the building up or keep programs going. But that comes a little bit later.
Okay. Yeah. I'll ask you about that.
Okay. But anyway, once we came back the second day, the first day we demonstrated was April 30th, 1969. Then May 1st, 1969, we came back and took over a building that was the Dean of Arts and Sciences office. And if you go north on campus, where Parish Court is now, is where that building used to be. So they tore it down years ago. But we took that over the second day, and that was the day that police ended up breaking in. We all ended up going to jail and the whole deal. And the week after that, there was a kind of almost like a star chamber hearing out here, where we were kicked out of school. Most of us were kicked out of school.
Well, had the hearing in the court actually happened before the hearing happened?
There was a hearing. We'd been found guilty, but we were out on bail on appeal. All that happened real fast. And the case itself didn't go back to court again until the winter of 1970. Now, we had one person who got arrested with us who had no business being in that building. She, Lord knows why she was there. But she, she testified, she said some interesting things about Bob, at least. She didn't say anything interesting about me. But she wanted to claim that we forced her to stay in the building, which was not true. But make a long story short, it turned out that by the time we did go to court, there were a million different laws that they could have charged us with violating, and we were guilty of those. But the one they charged us under was this Anti-Riot Act that they had passed in Kentucky right around that time, a year or so before that. And under the provisions of the Anti-Riot Act, the police had not done what they were supposed to do. In other words, they couldn't make it stick. So ironically, we got off, and we were prepared to go to jail. It was a weird little feeling, but you know, we were all making our preparations for, you know, however long it was going to be, we were going to be in jail. And
what were the police supposed to have done under the statute?
Well, a couple of things. One, there has to be some kind of announcement or notification that you know, they have to give you some kind of notice to stop doing whatever it is you're doing, or vacate the premises or whatever. And they hadn't done that. And even some of their own people testified that they didn't hear this man say anything about all that stuff. All they saw was people just bust out the door. And it was a technicality. That's all it was. But I've always felt that they manufactured the technicality. They didn't want to keep that going. What's interesting about that, though, Betsy, is that the person, in a way, who helped us make our case, because we were represented by people from Legal Aid, oddly enough, John O'Mara, Dennis Bricking, who's still around here in Louisville. They came out here one day down to the BSU office over in Old Student Center and just asked if they could if we had representation, which we didn't, and said they'd be willing to represent us, and they did. But interestingly enough, when we went to court the first time, right after we were arrested, the person who helped us make our case more than anybody else was a district attorney. And that was J. Earl Deering. Old Republican Mr. Deering. But Deering was black, and he was the one that questioned us. And since he saw we didn't have competent representation at the time, Deering brought out in his questions the issues that eventually got us off. And I've told his wife this, but he's been dead a long time. But I always had a tremendous amount of respect for him for doing that, because that was his way. And you could tell the judge and them knew what he was doing, and they were just seething. But it was within his right to do that. And he put all the stuff on the record that needed to be on the record that eventually would get us out of going to jail. He had a lot of weird stuff like that. You know, my mother had to put our house up to get all of us out of jail, as I'm sure she probably told you. And
actually,
there was just a lot of that.
She didn't tell me that. She told me that you had a family relative, a cousin who was a bondsman.
Yeah.
Put up the bail for all of us, but she didn't tell me how.
Well, she had put the house up.
She secured the bond.
Yeah,
right.
She had put the house up, and oh yeah.
Okay.
But that's what got us all out of jail. And
who was arrested? Can you give me names and something about them?
Well, I can give you the best. I think I can remember everybody. Person I was closest to was a man named Bob Martin, Robert Martin. Bob's a physician now. He works in Hawaii. But Bob and I were as close as brothers. We still are, really. You know, we see each other a couple times a year even now. We used to call him Wild Bob back in those days, though he was a wild character, to say the least. When Bobby was there, he was sort of like our Minister of Defense, you might say. The woman who decided that she was being held there by force was a woman named Sharon Clark. Sharon would regret that most of the rest of her. I don't know what happened to Sharon, but I know she went through a lot of changes after that.
She's still in Louisville?
I have no idea. Okay. I haven't seen her for years. Renelda Meeks was in there, Reginald Meeks' older sister. Rennie was our resident little black hippie. Interesting lady. Good people. A fellow named Phil Ferris, who was Rennie's boyfriend at the time. And
Ferris,
F-E-R-R-I-S.
Okay.
Don't know what happened to Phil. Phil was into a kind of a little counterculture thing, too. You had, was a fellow named Ed and Sanford. God, I'm trying to remember if Edna Green was in there. We had a couple of students, Alvin Bikes and Omar, or Henry Williams, was in there. Omar didn't get arrested. Because some of the people walked out, and those of us that we made them carry us out, as they cleared the way, they pushed some of the earlier folks into the crowd, and Henry got away. I remember seeing Henry disappear into the distance as they were putting the rest of us in the paddy wagon. I could find out some of those folks I haven't seen for so long.
I just didn't. You're the only name I've ever heard.
Oh yeah, but there were a number of other. There were about 10 people altogether, and then people like Jerry, Neil, and Claude McCollum, and some of the rest were out in front on the steps of the building. They didn't get arrested because they weren't breaking the law, but they were out there, and even just about all the black athletes at U of L, because there were a bunch of real crazy whites who wanted to break into that building. And a lot of the big black football players and those folks sort of formed like a little line in front of the building. So they weren't in the building, but they in a sense were part of what we were doing.
How long were you inside before the police arrived?
We were in there a few hours, several hours. I forget just how long it was now. It was long enough time though. I spent most of my time in there because we had to write a press statement and all that stuff, so I did that. And mainly trying to, we had some younger students in there that I had to try to calm down. So Bob's job was to watch, guard the door and all that kind of stuff. And my job was kind of try to keep some sort of order with everybody else inside. And then we had people stationed around campus and stuff, top of buildings and things, just let us know what was going on. There was supposed to be a lot more people there that day. Most folks don't realize that the dean's office or the dean's building of ANS was not our goal. We had planned to take over the whole student center that day. But there were a lot of folks who, in some of the community groups that we had alliances with, that never showed up. Now, we found out that police were picking these people up all over town. So we had an informant. We never did. I think I know who it was, but we never could prove it for sure. But I'm 99% sure I know. So there was an informant. I mean, somebody, let the police know what our plan was, because when it came down to it, we just didn't have enough people to take control of a large building like the student center. But we did have enough people, we thought, to take control of a smaller building like this one. So that's how we ended up there, but that was not our original plan.
Tell me about the press coverage. How much was there? Was it sympathetic? Was it oppositional?
There was a fair amount of it, I think, that was pretty sympathetic. We managed, I think, not to cross certain lines. As I look back on it, we kept our focus on issues pretty well. So you didn't get into the personality and name calling kind of stuff. We got called a bunch of them, but we didn't get into that a lot ourselves. Our agenda was a pretty radical agenda, but our methods were not unusual for the time. I mean, there were some of us who went around armed at various times. We had sense enough not to take arms into that building, because we'd probably still be in jail right now, be in a graveyard. But, we always saw that you sort of escalate gradually. So we had a fair amount of support.
From the Louisville Courier Journal?
Courier, I think, reported, their reporting was pretty well balanced. I wouldn't say they went out of their way to, wave the flag for us. But as I can recall, the Courier and some of the local TV stations were pretty well balanced. I mean, they let us get our message out the way we wanted to get it out. And that didn't always make people happy, but that it did come through the way we wanted it to. And in some ways, the coverage then was better than the kind of coverage you get now, particularly when you look at the broad spectrum of ideas that was on the table. But anyway, after we got arrested and all that goes down,
I'm going to stop you just a minute, James. Okay. Talking about the media coverage, and I wondered, what about the student newspaper? Was it called the Louisville Cardinal, then?
Okay. It was pretty good. We had a fairly liberal editor and some writers. And they probably covered a lot of things that the local press didn't cover. I used to have some copies of some of that old stuff. They would certainly print most of our press statements, which was nice. Mm-hmm. But the campus was a lot more liberal then too. And while you did have kind of, you know, your typical little young Republican group out here, there were a fair number of folks on campus who were, you know, SDS type characters. So we had a fairly broad base of support among that liberal to radical group of whites, and of course many of them hung around us a lot, and some of them, you know, were pretty good friends. There was one white person got arrested with us. You know, he insisted on, you know, he wasn't in the building with us, but I forget his name right now, but he got arrested. And
he just wanted to be arrested in support of what you were doing.
Yeah, he was doing his own demonstration out in front of the building. And so you had some of that. I mean, you know, Louisville was never a real liberal city. Not now, I wasn't then. Let that ring. But Louisville's always had a segment of its population that's been pretty progressive. So that's been good news for people coming from other parts of the country with kind of progressive politics and so forth, because if they could link up with that segment of Louisville's community, they could feel pretty comfortable. But the overall community has been generally conservative in spite of that. But we had a fair amount of support. I mean, you know, this is where I got to know people like Susie Post. This is where I got to know people like Ann and Carl Braden.
Out of this whole incident.
Oh, yeah. Well, and see, beyond a certain point, after we got arrested and expelled from school, you know, it was illegal for me to come back on U of L's campus for a period of time.
I wanted to hear about what happened when you were expelled.
So to continue to print things we wanted to print and do that kind of stuff, you know, we used the printing facilities that Ann and Carl had. And you sit down there and end up talking about Stalinism with Carl, but which was always an interesting conversation. But you know, their son's a year younger than I am, so I knew Jimmy at Mayo. And of course, you know, like I said, we've known each other for a long, long time. We go back more than 30 years. And again, Susie Post was one of the people who contacted me after, you know, a lot of this stuff blew up, and essentially I just offered her support.
Through the ACLU?
Well, and just personally, ACLU and just personally. So it's, you know, we go back a long way too, and there are others. Pat Delahanty, there are some of the folks in the Catholic Church, because my mother became a Catholic, as I'm sure she told you, after I got out of high school. But that sort of progressive white community in Louisville was very supportive. And
now, were all of you expelled?
No, not all. There was a sense of who the ringleaders were. You know, Bob and I were the main ones that kind of got as close to a death penalty as you could get. Some folks got back in the fall, and we essentially were able to come back to school in the spring of 1970. There was a big hassle over the courses I was enrolled in the semester that I got kicked out of school. And I think all those grades eventually turned into W's except one. And that was in a philosophy class. It was an ethics class, interestingly enough. And John Fludstrom, who was just retired out here a couple of months ago, John insisted on giving me an A in that class. It's real interesting. So, but there was some support on the faculty, and even Strickler. You know, President Strickler was a classic example of an essentially liberal and well-meaning man who was in a situation that forced him to act against, I think, some of his instincts. You know, Strickler was in the process of trying to negotiate U of L's way into the state system, which meant that Strickler was getting Kentucky politics all over him, which is not always a good way to stay clean. And, of course, UK had its own idea about what role U of L should have in the state system at that time. And Strickler was able to pull it off, but Strickler had to deal with the fact that Kentucky had a very reactionary governor at that time, Louis Nutt. So, you know, he had a real interesting problem to try to solve. Of course, we didn't make it any easier for him. But he and I remained very on friendly terms, interestingly enough. He gave me some financial aid to help me get back in school.
Well, when you were expelled, Blaine, did you think that you would just sit out and come back here? Did you think
I never
about
thought I'd come back
going
here.
Back, going I somewhere never, else? Or?
I never thought I would come back here. And honestly, I think deep down inside, I always felt that I would complete my education. But I was looking at a lot of options. You know, one of those options, obviously, was, you know, a more full-time involvement in the movement. Of course, this is the period of time when the movement itself begins to unravel, and there wasn't going to be anything to be involved in full-time before long. And that became a problem. In a big way the next couple of years when I was in that period of my life. There was a time in the early 70s when the movement, as we thought of it, was pretty much in a shambles. That I thought very seriously about going to Africa. A friend of mine and I thought very seriously about trying to move to Tanzania. Because I always had a lot of respect for Nyerere and what he was trying to do, African socialism, the whole deal. But, you know, it's the same battle wherever you go, and you can always fight that battle closer to home. But it was a very attractive idea, given where the country was going then.
I believe you lost your scholarship, though.
Oh, sure.
As a result of all this,
yeah.
Even though I think I recall your mother saying you got a very nice letter. Mm-hmm. Saying they supported you, but they couldn't support you financially. But was that a consideration, though, for you in terms of thinking about where to go next?
I didn't think about that at all. If I had to look back on the couple of years that sort of contained that period. Those issues were not really the uppermost issues on my mind. You know, movement-related things played a significant role. A lot of personal stuff, you know. There've always been several women in my life, at least in those days it were, so dealing with that was always interesting. Interesting's probably too tame a word, but it was fun. But that was always an issue. My poetry. I saw myself, you know, making an impact in a different kind of way. And as I got older and as it became clear, well, let me go back. Maybe I should do it this way. For someone who was 19, almost 20 years old, the day we walked out of court in the spring of 69. I mean, most of my life had played itself out against the backdrop of the civil rights era and then the immediate aftermath of that. I mean, you know, through my whole, all of my experience had been rooted in a time when this nation, however grudgingly, was making progress in the area of race. Now, of course, I can look back now and understand that around 66 or so, that progress stopped. But, you know, there was no reason to believe in 68 or 69 that was as far as we would get, or that some of the other ways in which American society needed to change would not actually happen. We look back now, 30 years later, and realize that that's as far as we ever got on many of those issues. But I think what a lot of us dealt with then, we were prepared to live in a very different kind of world. Certainly people in my generation, you know, I was not old enough to have been shaped by segregation. My emotional and my psychological makeup was not a part of that. Now, you know, I know people only a few years older than me who are still trying to deal with that. They have a hard time admitting it, but they're still trying to deal with it. And Lord knows, you get to people 10 or 15 years older than me. Something about how they look at themselves and the rest of the world got distorted in some cases back then. And some people have taken a long, hard road to try to get that, you know, warped part sort of bent straight again. But, you know, to a great extent, a lot of people in my generation didn't have that problem. Our experience was a different one, and different from the experience of kids now, who in a sense live in a world that's in some ways more segregated than the one I dealt with when I was a college student out here. So we were prepared to live in a different kind of world. Now, of course, the problem came in when that different kind of world didn't come into existence. And initially, if you think back, and, you know, and I've thought about this a lot over the years, but if you think back, after King gets assassinated, after Kennedy gets assassinated, you know, for a little while, people felt, I think, that, well, if you just try a little harder, push a little harder, you know, go a little farther, that we can get this whole thing back on track. And then it began to dawn on people after Richard Nixon got comfortable in the White House that wasn't going to do it, that there was really a systematic effort in play to suppress the movement, not to fulfill the movement, but to suppress it. And what that did, of course, is leave a lot of us with some real, real nasty choices to make. People who were involved in a lot of that stuff back then, and I'm sure you've talked to others, will tell you that some of the most interesting material is what people never talk about. All the emotional and psychological turmoil that people went through, how many people got strung out on alcohol or on drugs or crazy relationships, you know, reactions to the stress, you know, how many people joined the movement for therapeutic purposes anyway, and you know, there's all sorts of bizarre things that go into this. Well, you know, all the worst sides of it are what begins to bubble to the surface in the early 1970s. And, you know, you got to the point where you didn't know who you could trust. And of course that brought some of us who've been involved in BSU much closer together, because you know those kind of experiences test you individually, but they also test the relationships that you have, and you know who's going to back you up.
How many of that group though, Blaine, came back to U of L?
Well, Bobby did. Bobby graduated and then went on to Minnesota to get his medical degree. Jerry Neal eventually finished law school. I eventually finished. It's the younger ones, for the most part, that got lost. More than anything else, the younger people are the ones that in a sense couldn't negotiate that transition. And you know, I could tell you, and my mother, I think, knows this in kind of a different sense, but there were two or three years when, in a sense, I was really trying to find a direction. And it wasn't that I didn't know what I wanted to do. The problem was that there didn't seem to be any way to do it, or anywhere to do it. And so ultimately, this whole, a combination of things began to come together. One was working with kids. And that's why I was saying earlier, you know, some of my earlier experiences, like working as a tutor at Russell, you know, a friend of mine and I organized a tutoring program for other kids in the library when I was in junior high school. I worked for the Urban League as a tutor when I was in high school. But a lot, and of course what I did out here. But a lot of those things ultimately turned out to be experiences that served me well. Program development, taking ideas, putting them on paper, making them work in practice, turned out to be something that served me well out here in later years. But the notion of doing something tangible, you know, some kind of work in the real world, was in a sense where I ended up. And slowly that began to evolve into a kind of another vision of how I could do what I wanted to do. But it would take a long time to really get fully prepared to implement that.
I want to go back, though, to when you were expelled and ask you, mm-hmm. what did you do before you came back to school, and how did you feel? How did you make the decision to actually come back here?
Well, I worked for the poverty program, summer '69, and then I worked at Plymouth Settlement House beginning in the fall. I stayed there until the early 1970, but Morris Jeff, who was director, was a good friend of mine, and he hired me as kind of an evening programming person. And then
Chester Grundy and Ann.
Yeah, Chester and Ann.
Period too, they?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they were there then.
Okay.
And CAC work was in the summer. I was like a youth program director.
CAC,
Community Action Commission.
Commission.
And so, you know, I was able to find a dollar or two here and there. And of course, we had what we call the Black Liberation Center. That's the house that I was talking about down at, it was on 28th Street between Grand and, Grand and Hale, I think. And so we had that, and I spent, you know, my hours were down there in the evening. And so I had plenty of time, plenty to do. Of course, we were meeting all the time, going different places, and doing things that young people do a lot, chasing around after women and all that. And there were always plenty of those around. It's almost like being, you had groupies in a way. It was wild. And Bob and I were the main ones they chased after. Bob was married during all this too, by the way. I was not. I was supposed to be engaged, but that was sort of a technicality. But you know, it was plenty to keep you occupied. In the fall, you know, you had the Office of Black Affairs in place. You had this first group of scholarship students out here. The main reason why I came back to U of L was very simple. Most of the students that they brought in were students we'd organized in these high school BSUs. And the students had wanted us to come back. In some ways, we were ready to take the position that, okay, we had done what we needed to do at U of L. Now we want to turn our attention to working on issues in the community, because this is the year we started Stop Dope Now, you know, when Sterling did, which is one of the most, I think, far-sighted things we ever did. People thought we were crazy. Little did they know. But that's when you first began to notice that the availability of drugs was becoming something very different, right around then. But it's the students who took the position that, you know, we were being irresponsible. You know, you did all this stuff to get us out here, and now you're going to walk away and leave us. And so it was not a hard decision to make in the end. It's just one of those things that sort of led naturally from, you know, one point to another. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Blaine, whether there were any other protests to this degree, particularly that involved arrest and hearings, at any of the other Kentucky higher ed institutions. Were you a model?
Well, at UK, of course, as I said, there was I think there were about four people who got arrested for this firebombing charge around the same time. And then some other places you had smaller little flare-ups, but probably nothing as far out as what we had here. There were some students at Male High School, Henry, Omar and his group, that they got pretty rambunctious. But K-State and some other places were fairly quiet. Mm-hmm.
Tell me what happened at Male High School.
Just a student BSU, group of kids we had organized. They were demonstrating. I forget what the issue was. It might have been curriculum, but I think there was a trigger incident. And they were doing demonstrations in school. Some kids got kicked out and the whole deal. And we were able to get them out here on scholarship the next fall. And of course, they were some of the people who were the ringleaders of efforts to hassle the director of the Office of Black Affairs. That was interesting, too. But
it's rather there was ironic, that what you and Bobby and the others wanted, you've mm-hmm. achieved.
Yeah. It's it really is. It has surprised a lot of people. But I think a lot of that has to do with the nature of what we were trying to achieve and how we wanted the institution to change. I think that even though what we were trying to do seemed totally out of the box ideologically to a lot of people, it was not impractical from the standpoint of what can be done at an institution of higher education. We were not asking the University of Louisville to do anything that was really hard for it to do. It's the cases where people were asking institutions to make changes that were very difficult for them to make, given the kinds of institutions they were that had real problems. We were also in a position where I think one of our great advantages was the African-American community of Louisville. U of L was one of those institutions that was not way out in the boondocks someplace, where as soon as the group of radical students graduates or gets kicked off campus, wait a couple of years and everything that you promised you can renege on. In Louisville, you had a community that has been pretty good at keeping an eye on what's going on out here. You didn't really have that in Lexington. You got a black community in Lexington, but it really has no connection to the university. Doesn't want one most of the time either. But Louisville's different, from the time of Municipal College to the basketball, the football teams and all that. To some extent, people have seen, the African-American community has seen itself as having a stake in what happens here. And that was one of our big advantages. And then, like I said, I think by keeping the focus on the issues and on programs and things that did turn out to be constructive, we've been able to make some headway. I mean, none of this stuff is finished yet, even 30 years later.
I'm going to stop for now, and we'll pick it up at some other point, maybe if we need to. Thank you. Is there anything else that you want to add?
Oh, I can't think of anything now, Betsy. It's just remembering across 30 years is an interesting experience in and of itself now.
There is one other thing I was thinking while you were talking. You mentioned writing poetry several times.
Oh, sure.
And I wondered if you were, or how much of a black arts community mm-hmm. Grew up here with nationalism.
Well,
were you part of that in any way?
In a way. I've always seen myself as, I guess my primary identity has more to do with my writing than anything else. And people who've known me for a long time know that, but it's not something that comes up that often anymore because I don't have a chance to do much of it anymore. But there was Louisville's had a history of producing a number of pretty good black artists, painters, musicians, writer here and there. When I was a freshman, Robert Hayden, the poet, was the Bingham professor here, like a visiting professor in residence. And I had a freshman English teacher, who's still out here as a matter of fact, who showed him some of my poetry, because she and I were, she liked my poetry, and she was helping me publish stuff. and she showed him some of it, and we did a poetry reading together. You know, it was really one of the high points of that period in my life. And you know, one of the things I did during all these, you know, periods when there was so much turmoil going on was I wrote a lot. So that filled a lot of time too. I mean, there was a period in there when I had time enough to, you know, really concentrate and do some plays and that kind of thing. So I published a little bit then. Much of this material I didn't really publish until years later. And it's interesting, one of the last promises I made my grandmother was that I would start publishing my poetry again, because I'd stopped for a long time. I didn't stop writing it, but I stopped publishing it. And from, maybe about 88 until 92, when I moved here, back to teaching full-time again, I published, hundreds of pieces of it. And it's interesting, because most of it was 20 years old by then. But there was still a market for it.
What sort of mediums were you publishing?
Different poetry magazines, journals, anthologies. And if I ever get back to it, I had a couple of offers to do, you know, collections. But the response was very good. You know, I never published it that close to Louisville. I didn't want to mix apples and oranges, because you need to be clean and clear emotionally to do that stuff. But I published stuff all over the country, and so I got back into doing it. But but that's always been very much a part of how I've operated. And so, you know, I did some writing for some people who were painters, like my cousin Fred, Fred Bond, and Bob and some of them, Bob Douglas and some of them. You know, we used to do things, people do some artwork, and I'd do a little verse piece and stuff. You know, but, you know, so much other stuff going on, you're sort of hitting and missing, that kind of thing.
I do have one final question now that has to do with writing, and that's about your dissertation. Mm-hmm. You finished in 1981. Tell me why you chose the topic that you did.
Municipal College?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
the history of the
Municipal College, right. In a way, it combined a lot of themes that I liked. You know, one of it was historical, another that it had an educational focus. And probably the third was that I think, you know, the Municipal College story is a very important story for Kentucky and for Louisville. I had initially planned on doing a statistical dissertation, and actually had developed a couple of pieces that were almost dissertation length just through institutional research out here. But actually I got tired of it. And historical research is really my preference. So I set aside the earlier ideas and got my committee to agree to let me do the historical one. And I've always been glad I did that. But
have you ever thought about publishing it?
I had offers to publish it after I finished it. And I published a couple of articles out of it, and I may get back to doing the whole thing, but I was so focused on doing administrative work back then that I regretted not publishing it, to be honest, but I just didn't do it then. And I'm into this antebellum stuff now, so it'll be a while before I get back to that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.